a conversation with the woman in charge of regulating Maine's farms, forests, and conservation efforts. Commissioner Amanda Beale has a lot on her plate. Since becoming head of Maine's Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry, she's overseen the Mills administration's response to a range of issues. Farming in Maine is in transition, with traditional farms in decline, but more young farmers taking to the land. The U.S. trade war with China is impacting the state's agriculture industry, and Maine's organic growers are concerned about the loosening of organic standards in other states. In Maine's forests, Beale's department is battling the emerald ash borer and other pests, and there is ongoing debate about the Land for Maine's Future program. I'm Keith Shortall, and Commissioner Beale joins us to discuss the issues affecting the state's natural resources. And as always, we want to hear from you. Maine Calling is next. First, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios in Augusta, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. Agriculture in Maine is in transition. Maine's forests are one of its most important resources, and conservation efforts play a vital role in keeping Maine, Maine. My guest today is Amanda Beale. She's the state's Commissioner of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Before taking on that role, she served as Maine Farmland Trust's president and CEO. Commissioner Beale, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me here.
And as always, we want to hear from you. What do you think should be Commissioner Beale's priorities? Conservation, agriculture promotion and protection, state park access and maintenance. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. As I was preparing for the show, I'm kind of going over all of the silos, no pun intended, that you oversee and that you guide. And it's really a lot of stuff. You've got a lot on your plate. And, you know, as you may know, about the time you were taking over, there was a proposal to kind of rend apart the department. And some people felt that maybe agriculture wouldn't get its due attention if connected with all these other important areas. You've been in this position for a while. What's your take on whether the department is right-sized?
That's a great question. Yeah, I've been in this position for almost 6 months now, so I have some inside perspective. And also, you know, having worked in the agriculture and conservation sectors prior to coming to the state, I have that experience as well. First, people that don't know, in, you know, 2012-2013, a merger was sort of completed where the Department of Conservation and the Department of Agriculture were brought together to be one merged department. And it is large, it's diverse, it's complicated. The areas that we oversee are very technical and also represent a large sector of our natural resource economy. And so, you know, I from where I sit, I think also bringing my previous experience into the room, I think I have had a real appreciation for, sort of the overall opportunities and conservation benefits that can come from both protected and working lands. And so I see that as a thread that really does carry through all of the different pieces of work that we do. Whether it's directly working on, you know, market access in agriculture or forestry, or whether we're talking about, you know, the science and the really important folks like the geologists and the entomologists and ecologists who do the great research on the ground to support these industries. So I do think they hang together in a lot of ways, and also, as I had said before, being so important and part of the natural resource-based economy, it's clear to me that there are a lot of opportunities to look for synergies.
But is it, clearly, as you pointed out, you have experience in two of these areas, in conservation and in agriculture, less so probably in forestry. But is it going to be a tall order to find commissioners with background and interest and skill in all three areas?
I would say so, yes. And I will admit that forestry has been an area of great, you know, it's a steep learning curve, but it's exciting. There's a lot of really interesting innovation and opportunity that's percolating in the forestry industry right now, which we'll hear more about later. But Yes, it is. It's a big and broad charge to find somebody who would have the expertise in all of these areas. And I think that's where having really strong bureau directors and other folks in leadership positions within the department, where that becomes very important. And that's something that we've spent a lot of time and energy in assembling.
So that some of this is long-term planning and big problems to which there are only long-term solutions. Some of it's more pressing and in the news. Mm-hmm. I take, for example, this issue with Maine's blueberry growers. Mm-hmm. So we will talk a little bit in a moment about how the crop is looking. But there was this issue that, as with other crops that were affected adversely by this trade war we're having with China. But for a number of reasons, the blueberry growers would not qualify for relief, as others are, under this federal program that kind of helps out sectors of the agriculture economy that are hurt by trade mm-hmm. disputes. And can you just explain kind of why blueberry growers aren't able to get this help and what could be done about it?
That's a really good question. And so that is determined by the USDA and so at the federal level. So we wrote a letter actually to Secretary Sonny Perdue requesting that they look at this again. Why is it that our wild blueberries weren't included where other crops such as cranberries and grapes were eligible? And we have not received an official response yet. We expect to in the next few weeks. Regardless of what that response is, we're really committed to continuing to work to support our wild blueberry growers.
I had read some background material saying that the program is intended for crops that aren't easily used in school food programs or through food banks. Mm-hmm. Had you heard that?
Yeah. But I mean, the reality is that the wild blueberry industry has had a direct impact from the tariffs in terms of their ability to export and to sell their wild blueberries abroad. So there is real impact there, and we do think it should be addressed.
Sure. Well, let's talk to Patricia Contour. She's the acting executive director of the Wild Blueberry Commission of Maine. Patricia, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you hear us?
Yes,
yeah.
I can.
So as you know, the USDA apparently has balking, for lack of a better word, on letting blueberry growers participate in this relief program. What kind of relief were farmers hoping for?
I think farmers were hoping for to receive the direct payments for trade mitigation that would be supplemental to their 2019 income, rather than past crop production and mitigation for that. So that would be in addition.
I see. So has USDA officially then rejected the request to participate in the program, or do you know?
No, they haven't officially rejected the request from my point of view. And in my conversations that I had with USDA and USDA officials, I understand that it's a long process, and it's not. And we entered into the process a little bit late in the formulation of the rules, and that there's still a potential opportunity in the fall for us to be added in.
Are there any other options for farmers who are being hurt by this trade war?
I think that the option would be that to diversify, which a lot of farmers are already undertaking for this season, going into more sales channels, product development, and entering new markets. I think that if they are interested, they can qualify for other USDA programs like the Market Access Program. And also, we are selling currently and have increased sales into the School Food Service Program, as well as other food purchase programs. So it might help to mitigate the loss of revenue there.
Yeah. As for this year's crop, I had read that there's concern that it's, again, this year, not going to be as robust as some previous years. How would you say the crop is looking, and what kind of support would you like to see from the administration?
As far as the crop goes, the wild blueberries in the field are of good quality, and we're just beginning a harvest as of last week or within the last 7 to 9 days, and we have to see what the final production numbers will be, but we have had a lot of weather issues over the last 6 to 8 months, weather in the winter that affected the crop this year, as well as in the spring with pollination and wet weather and getting into the fields to do some field work that we usually do in the spring. So we have a potential for a lower number. I agree with that. We're not sure quite yet if that will improve with if we get rain in the next few days or if we get a lot of sunshine in the next few days. Mother Nature is often the deciding factor.
And that was it a cold winter that was part of the issue?
You know, if you recall, we had we didn't have much snow, but then we had freezing temperatures, and the blanket of snow that covers the buds that were set in the fall is really helpful, and the wild blueberries are very accustomed to dealing with our harsh winters. But if the freezing occurs without the blanket of snow, then the buds at the ends of the stems then freeze, and then it reduces the budding and the opening of flowers in the spring.
Okay, we've got to move along. I appreciate it very much. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Patricia Contour is the Acting Executive Director of the Wild Blueberry Commission of Maine. I wanted to switch gears a little bit here, Commissioner, to this another issue that's been in the news, which is having to do with organic standards. I guess there's a concern that some other states are loosening organic standards by allowing in animals that may, anyway, the way that they're brought into the herd is a concern. Could you just explain that and why it's important?
Yes. Yeah, so recently, actually, the governor and I sent yet another letter to the USDA asking for the origin of livestock rule to be clarified. And it's not so much that states are allowing, different standards to be in play. It's that organic certifiers are interpreting that rule a little bit differently in different places. And, you know, really the spirit of the rule is that you can transition your livestock one time into an organic herd. But there are places where farmers are being allowed to transition once and then continue to transition in additional animals later, when really what they're supposed to be doing is breeding and, you know, resupplying their own herd needs from their existing herd. And so we were really asking for that to be more consistently applied and for those rules to be clarified, because it has an impact on our farmers. Our certifier, our main certifier here in the state, is the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, LLC, and they actually are upholding the spirit of the rule. And so our farmers are sort of playing by the rules and being, challenged with having to compete with those who are not.
And that's because of cost. In other words, the cost is the driver here.
That
and Maine
would be.
Farmers, by doing good, are at a disadvantage?
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
It's not just about the purity or organics, although that's part of it, but it's also an economics issue.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Right.
Well, let's bring in now Sarah Alexander, who is the executive director of MOFCA. Sarah, thanks for joining us. Can you hear us?
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So you heard the explanation there. You're obviously aware of this issue, but why, from your point of view, why is this issue important for members of your constituency?
Yeah, well, the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, we certify about 535 operations in the state. And as Amanda mentioned, you know, we are following kind of the letter of the law, the highest standard for the National Organic Program. And unfortunately, there are some dairies out west who are not following these rules, or their certifier are interpreting the rules in a different way. And we estimate that it costs Maine dairy farmers about $600 to $1,200 more per calf to raise them organically than if they were to raise them conventionally and then have them come back into the herd. And so this is an important issue for Maine dairies. About a third of the dairies in the state of Maine are organic dairies. And so it's an important part of our economy here. And we want to make sure that they're playing on a level playing field and we're able to support them and make sure that, you know, everybody's following the same set of rules. So we've been working with the department as well as our congressional delegation, and all of Maine's congressional delegation has been a champion in support of this issue. And so we're working right now with the congressional delegation and the department to tell the USDA that they need to issue a final rule and make sure that all of these dairies are playing by the same rules.
And I imagine sooner rather than later, as the longer this continues, there's more pressure on other states to loosen their standards as well.
Yeah, we want them to take action. Actually, this rule was initially proposed and finalized in 2015. So it was under the previous federal administration, and it's been sitting there ready to go, and there's near unanimous consensus in the organic industry that this rule is needed. So really the work with both the department and the letter that the governor sent, as well as the work at the congressional level, is to essentially tell the USDA that they need to do their job and they need to do it quickly because we do have dairy farms who are in tough economic situations. I mean, the dairy industry as a whole is having some challenges right now with oversupply, but organic is not immune to that, even though organic producers do have a better market generally. And we've seen the organic market increase here in the state of Maine over the last 5 years. The ag census just came out. So product sales in Maine for organic producers between 2012 and 2017 increased from $36 million to $60 million a year. And we've grown from 417 producers to 535. So we're definitely moving in the right direction in terms of the organic industry here in Maine being a bigger part of the market, and those markets being more stable, allowing farmers to invest in their businesses and continue to grow their operations. But this rule in particular would really help organic dairies who really are competing against those big Western dairies. And we're talking about, you know, some of these Western dairies have tens of thousands of cows. I think one of the largest operations here in Maine for organic dairy farming milks about 150 cows. So the scale is very different. And, you know, we're convinced that the Maine farmers are really doing things the way they should be, the right way, and we're certifying to the standards as they were intended, but we want to see those other states follow the same rules.
All right, Sarah, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Sarah Alexander, the Executive Director of Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments for Commissioner Amanda Beal. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Crossroads, offering Maine's only gender-responsive residential treatment center for eating disorders and addiction. CrossroadsME.org. New England Forestry Foundation, celebrating 75 years of conserving forests for future generations. Learn more at newenglandforestry.org. And Lee Auto Malls, sampling local brews and local breads with MOFCA on August 17th in Unity. More at mofca.org.
For decades, the Chinese government's one-child policy reshaped the way people there thought about family.
At some point, it just became a normal part of life, just like the air, the water, the tree. You stop questioning because it has always been there.
A Chinese-born filmmaker explores how the policy affected the country and her family. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up this afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret history of Koch Industries and how the Koch brothers changed corporate and political power in America. We talk with Christopher Leonard, author of Kochland. It describes how Koch Industries acquired huge businesses while limiting Koch's liability and created a political influence network that set out to remake the Republican Party. Join us.
And you can hear that this evening at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Amanda Beal is my guest. She's the Commissioner of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We've talked a little bit about the trade war with China and its effect on Maine farmers, but I want to focus on dairy in particular. We heard Sarah Alexander of MOFCA talking about the organic dairy farmers and their challenges. But here in Maine, as we know, I've covered this for years, there's been a decline in the traditional dairy industry. But there are some sort of numbers that are being that I've read about connected to real losses in the dairy industry from the tariff situation. And in one case, I think there was a statistics of for a typical operation of 150 cows that might have been a loss of income of $50,000 for over a 6-month period was one number that I heard from. But you're familiar with this, obviously. How is it affecting the dairy industry in Maine?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we have to just sort of take a step back and understand that, you know, our dairy industry is really important to the overall agriculture sector. You know, our dairy farms are sort of anchors for other kinds of services that other types of farms rely upon. And so dairy farms use a pretty large land base, keep a lot of land in production working. They're also, you know, farmers are generally very welcoming and generous with their community members, giving people, you know, places to recreate and hunt and things like that. So important to communities and anchors for services like, you know, large equipment dealers and large animal vets. And so when they go away, it creates a real void and can make it more expensive for other farmers to access those types of things that they need because they maybe have to travel further afield to get to them or to access them. So just, you know, that context. And then we look at, you know, there's usually a cycle of price fluctuations. And so, you know, dairy farmers are used to good times and bad times. But when you add stressors onto the regular cycle like these tariffs, it's just an incredible burden for them to bear. And margins are very tight, risk is high, and it doesn't take much to have a really significant impact on a dairy farm's viability when we're talking about, you know, something like a $50,000 impact on a farm with a herd of 150 cows. That is significant. And so it just really further stresses them and puts them in a tougher position than they're already in.
Let's bring in some industry perspective. Joining us now is Julie Marie Bickford, Executive Director of the Maine Dairy Industry Association. Julie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
How is the dairy industry doing in Maine these days in this context of this international trade situation?
Well, Amanda gave you a great kind of lay of the land for dairy. One of the dynamics that makes dairy kind of unique and a bit more vulnerable to variations in trade or weather or things like that is that you are either milking cows or you're not. There's no pause switch on a cow. So, and it's about a 10-month ramp-up time minimum to get cows into production. So, you know, any variations in the market conditions can have dramatic impacts on the price that a farmer has paid for the milk, for their milk. But it has very little to do with all the expenses that the farmer has put into getting that milk production up and running. So, you know, what we're seeing right now with the trade issues especially with China, is, you know, these are global dynamics that are really causing pressures. They have very little to do with what is going on here in Maine in terms of actually producing the milk, but they're having a drastic negative impact on the price the farmer is getting paid. And that is on top of, we're going into about a five-year cycle of historically low prices being paid for the milk. So, you know, it's sort of just, if you will, it's twisting the financial knife into each dairy farmer and really kind of making them, you know, they're beyond belt tightening, but they really have to, well, let's put it this way. Dairy farmers are in that kind of business because they love it. It's, you know, it's what they're good at. And any dairy farmer who's still producing milk in Maine is one heck of a business person.
Is there no relief for farmers when they find themselves in this kind of set of circumstances?
Well, at the federal level, they've been changing what they're offering for options of relief, and they've gone to what's more of like an insurance policy. So the farmer needs to pay in, this is our argument, pay in money that farmers really don't have right now, in order to buy insurance that maybe they'll get paid for the real value of their milk. Thankfully, we are very grateful that the state of Maine, going on almost 15 years now, has had a safety net program in place that does take into account what it costs to produce milk on the farm and provides the farmers that emergency kind of safety net payment. So I equate it to, it doesn't get farmers profitable, but it keeps them from falling into the big black hole of debt when there are these low prices, and it means that there is hope that they would someday be able to come out of it and be able to, you know, have the farm continue for many generations. And, you know, I thank Commissioner Beal and Governor Mills because they have continued that support for that program. Without it, most of the Maine dairy farmers would say they wouldn't still be in business.
And finally, is there anything that consumers can do to have a role in, I guess, supporting Maine dairy farmers?
Well, the number one thing is consume more dairy products. Go out and buy more dairy products would be the first thing. And keep in mind, when you're out in, whether it's at a farm stand or at the grocery store, you can make a choice to buy local. There's a really neat trick, whether it's a jug of milk or a package of butter or whatever, you can look on there for what's called a plant code. And if the code, it's usually a two-digit number and then a dash and another two-digit number. Well, if that first two-digit number is 23, that stands for Maine. And that means that that dairy product, whether it's the jug of milk or the butter or the cheese or the yogurt, whatever it might be, was produced in Maine. And, you know, we're fortunate that we've got some, you know, very visible Maine processors. You know, we've got Oakhurst and H.P. Hood in Portland. We've got Smiling Hill in Westbrook. We've got Holton Farms Dairy in Holton. They are all producing fluid milk for Maine people, but they're producing under not just their own name, they're some of the private store labels also. So look for the 23, and that's a good clue that you're you know, helping us by buying more dairy products, but you're also supporting Maine dairy farmers by keeping the demand up for the quality products that our farmers are producing.
All right, Julie Marie Bickford, Executive Director of the Maine Dairy Industry Association. Thanks for joining us. Thank you. All right, let's bring in a caller. Waiting patiently on the line is Matt in Woolwich, or Woolwich, depending on which one you choose. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for talking about agriculture today. Great topic. I'm a farmer out here. I'm actually on Swango Farm right now, picking tomatoes. And I love this work, but I'm finding it very difficult to have this be something that's viable. I mean, I'm just not making a living wage. And I would just be interested to hear your perspective on the future of farming viability.
All right, Commissioner Amanda Beal.
Great question. Thank you so much for taking time to call in. I know you are busy. this question of farm viability, it is a really, really important one. And, you know, even in my previous position at Maine Farmland Trust, this was a core concern of ours, and it continues to be a core concern of mine as I'm here at the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. I think, you know, there, from my perspective, what we can do at the department is try to continue to work with producers, to work with, buyers, to develop more market opportunities for farmers where you get paid a fair wage for the really hard work that you do. I think we've made some progress over, the past decade or so in that direction, but we definitely have more work to do. I think that, part of the key to that is looking at opportunities for value-added processing that, gives us the opportunity to keep more of the value-added dollar here in the state. I totally recognize the fact that, over the years we've seen this progression of less and less of the food dollar basically going back to the farmer. And, that is a really extractive trend that hurts farms, that hurts rural communities, that we have got to find both policy and market solutions for. So, I know at the department where we have some different programs where we're working on marketing, we're working on technical assistance to farmers around business planning, and there are other organizations in the state that do that as well. I would be happy, Matt, if you were wanting to talk more about this at a later date, I'd be happy to have a conversation with you, come out to your farm and talk about the resources that are available. But, I think a call to the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry is a good first step if you're looking for a way to connect to these various resources that are out there.
We haven't touched much on conservation. I want to go there next. Matt, thank you for your call. Conservation is part of this. There is in the news this a push, I guess, to by some to get the legislature to reconvene in time to get Land for Maine's Future money bond question on the November ballot. What's the status of that?
To my knowledge, I don't know that a date has been set for them to come back, and I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't really guess at what that's going to look like. But I do know that it's clear that there was tremendous public support for the Lands for Maine's Future program, so that if we are able to, get that bond package to move forward, we're really excited to have the opportunity to do more of the good work that LMF has been doing for years and years now.
Yeah. Do you support that?
Yes. Support them? Yes, yeah. Definitely. I mean, conservation, when we protect land, whether it's working waterfront or farmland or land for recreation, that has a direct impact on our economy and on many rural communities. And in so many people come to this state to recreate and to be tourists here because of these protected lands, these conserved lands. And so they're incredibly valuable to us as a state.
Let's bring in Jeff Romano, Public Policy Manager at Maine Coast Heritage Trust, who I'm sure is also in support of this. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I'm guessing you are in support of more money for Lands for Maine's Future, but why is it important, do you think?
Well, Land for Maine's Future and land conservation in general are very important to the state of Maine. We did a study a couple years ago at Maine Coast Heritage Trust, just looking at what land trusts do for the state in terms of economic and community benefits. There's been 2.6 million acres of land conserved in Maine by land trusts. That's 12.5% of the state. And these lands provide numerous benefits to the state economically. For example, the vast majority of these lands are working forests, actively managed for forest products, supporting Maine businesses like Robbins Lumber and Hancock Lumber, and benefiting loggers and foresters. Land trusts have also conserved nearly 40,000 acres of agricultural land supporting a lot of the farmers and ag businesses that you've been discussing thus far on the program today. Land trusts have also protected more than 60 locations along the Maine coast where commercial fishermen and clammers and wormers have guaranteed access to the ocean. In Maine, we have less than 25 miles of guaranteed access to the ocean on 4,000 miles. These are critical access points to maintain those industries and communities up and down the coast. And finally, the land trust community benefits the tourism industry significantly. We found that in the state of Maine, land trusts offer more than 1,200 miles of hiking trails, hundreds of miles of snowmobile, ATV, and mountain biking trails, and more than 200 boat launch sites and more than 200 beaches for both visitors and Maine residents to take advantage of these places throughout the state.
And, of course, this is as much in the current context, this is really as much a political question as it is one about planning, because it's been a political issue. And even to the extent that now we're trying to get the leadership to come back and convince, not necessarily ardent supporters of Lands for Maine's future to maybe go along with this. But what's your sense of where we are with this? Are you optimistic that you think the program will get more money in the next year or so? And what would you like to see?
Well, we're cautiously optimistic. We were working when the legislature was in session earlier this year on a bill called LD 911 that had bipartisan support in the legislature. 105 of the legislators in the state of Maine signed onto the bill. It would provide regular funding for the Land for Maine's Future program over the next 4 or 5 years. Our understanding is that the legislature's hasn't addressed bond issues, not because of Land for Maine's Future, just about other challenges that they're having coming up with an agreement among the various sides. But we're cautiously optimistic that this program will get funded. We're hopeful that the legislature will come back in later this month. The public has traditionally supported LMF to the tune of 65% or more, six times in the last 30 years. Maine voters have been asked to weigh in on Land for Maine's Future funding, and consistently Maine voters have said yes. And we hope the legislature and the governor will come together later this month and give Maine voters the opportunity to say yes once again.
Jeff Romano is Public Policy Manager at Maine Coast Heritage Trust. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Patriot Subaru, now featuring the 2019 all-wheel drive, 7-passenger Subaru Ascent. More at patriotsubaru.com. Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And Sweetgrass Farm Winery and Distillery, tasting wines and spirits in Union, Portland's Old Port, and at their new location in Kennebunk. Sweetgrasswinery.com.
Hello, I'm Jane Wales, host of World Affairs. Today, the world's most violent places are not at war. They're plagued with gang violence, organized crime, and state brutality. Next on World Affairs, Rachel Kleinfeld from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace will tell us how countries marred by violence have recovered.
And you can hear that this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. The next stop on the Maine Public News Tell Me More tour is Bar Harbor, as Maine Public News travels the state to hear directly from you, learn what you feel are the most important issues in your community, and how Maine Public News can best serve you and keep you informed. The event takes place this Thursday evening at 5:30 at the Abbey Museum. Deputy News Director Susan Sharon will be there, along with Week Edition host Jennifer Mitchell. For more information about all the Tell Me More tour visits, including Thursday's Bar Harbor event, please visit mainpublic.org and click on Events or the banner ad.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, a conversation with Maine Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry Commissioner Amanda Beal. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-399-3566. We've been talking about some sort of fires that are going on that have to be put out, and sort of more short-term issues. But I'm imagining that you, when you look forward to the next 4 years and beyond, it's against the backdrop of all of these other greater pressures, including climate change, that must inform the way you, as commissioner, think about forests, farming, conservation. And I know it's a big question, but look, specifically to forestry, when you're thinking about that, are you thinking forests, we know, are a carbon sink, and that's important, therefore we should keep more trees and cut down fewer? Is it as simple as that, or is that part of the equation in your thinking?
Well, in fact, the state of Maine is about 90% forested, so we're one of the most forested, I believe we're the most forested state in the country. So, I mean, we definitely have a lot of forest, and I'll also share that in recent years, growth has exceeded harvest by about 55%. So we're managing our forest inventory quite well, I would say, at this point in time. You know, I think there are questions we also need to be asking ourselves about, you know, the things that we can use forestry products for and whether they're replacing other manufactured items that maybe have even a greater climate impact. And just to say generally as well, you know, we're very excited about a bill that was passed. It was a governor's bill establishing a statewide climate council. And so that council is going to be meeting for the first time next month, and it's really going to be doing some important cross-cutting work, looking at opportunities for adaptation and mitigation, dealing with climate change issues in the state. And so we see our work in the Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry being very connected to what happens with the Climate Council, and we are going to be working very closely with that council to be thinking about where we go from here. So, but with that said, there is definitely a good conversation that we can be having around what role our forests play in mitigating carbon and acting as carbon sinks. But I think we're starting from a really good place.
I want to bring in Steve Shaler, the director of the School of Forest Resources at the University of Maine at Orono. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the program. Oh, it's my fault. Sorry. Sorry about that. Hi, Steve. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Pleasure. Thank you
Sorry.
For having me on board.
I missed a button there. Give us, as we all know, many of us know, forest resources, forest products have been such an important part of Maine's history and economy. Where would you say it stands now, and what does the future look like?
Well, it's a great question, and it all starts with the forest. As Commissioner Beal mentioned, Maine is the most forested state in the country, and that forest gives us a lot of benefits in terms of forest products, the industry that we know about. But we like to think of the forest as providing the four W's, if you will: wood, wildlife, water, and recreation. For those of you old enough to remember Bugs Bunny. And on the wildlife side, things that, you know, this large forest, this continuous privately owned forest in Maine, provides, for example, the largest population of lynx in the continental United States. And from the water side, Lake Sebago, the great water quality that Portland has, is due in large part to the water benefit that the forest around Lake Sebago provides. So forests are important, and if we look at the economy perspective, the latest study that we did here at the university put the economic impact at $8.5 billion. But if we look at it from a state perspective, that represents 20%, north of 20% of the gross domestic product, manufacturing gross domestic product of the state of Maine. That is larger than any other state in the country. So not only are we the most forested state, but the forest economy is more important to us than any other state. The next largest state in terms of importance is Arkansas at about 17%. So it's important. It's been here for a long time, and it's just key.
And we've heard, of course, or hear a lot about the decline of the paper industry. But what you're saying is we're not seeing the forest for the trees, that there is still an enormous, horrible, but there's a still a lot of potential here in other ways that that we're now looking at?
Yes, absolutely. And it's some of the other talkers or discussionists talked about evolving markets and new markets and new value added. And that's exactly what's happening in the forest products industry. The paper companies that are here are reinvesting and going into new applications. There's new products being looked at, whether it's for energy uses, whether it's for building products, whether it's for consumer applications that are diversifying, providing more value added. And in this world of more and more people, having the sustainably managed forest that we have in Maine, being sold and used all over the world is just really important.
Just about a minute left here. Can you talk a little bit about the FOR Maine initiative? That's FOR, I guess, / Maine initiative.
Yes. So FOR Maine is a collection of organizations started about 3 years ago. The University of Maine, BioBase Maine, Maine Development Foundation, Woodland Owners of Maine, a few others, that is its goal is to promote and grow the forest industry by 50% by the year 2025. And that's to promote new green-collar jobs for rural economy of the state. It's to prepare the workforce for the future and to manage the resource sustainably, but about that growth of $12 billion by 2025.
Yeah, and I understand you have a question for Commissioner Beal.
Yes, Commissioner Beal, in light of these dynamics that we talked about, climate change, global competition, changing markets, what is ACF looking at in terms of short- and long-term strategies on the health of our forests, its relation to forest economy and rural communities? A simple question.
Shouldn't take long.
And with the caveat, as we started this conversation, that I'm learning a lot about forestry really quickly. well, I mean, I'll just say that, you know, we're really interested. We've been interested, of course, in the efforts of the FOR Maine work that's been underway for a few years now. And we're supportive. We're definitely looking for ways to really to support and not come in and try to replace the work that's being done there on the ground, because it's been very well executed and thoughtful, and I think there's some good direction setting that's happened there. So we're here, you know, we're here to help. And in terms of climate and, you know, and how do we manage our forests going forward, I mean, I think, you know, our Maine Forest Service, we have such incredible resources there from the foresters, the district foresters, our entomology program, you know, and then our forest rangers, who are all really working with an eye on forest health and trying to spot things, whether it's pests or diseases as they're coming forward, or as we're anticipating that there could be a threat, and trying to be as responsive as possible. So, you know, we're definitely here to be as helpful as we can, and want to hear from folks in the forestry industry about what kind of support they need.
Okay, and with that, we're gonna let Steve go. Steve, thanks very much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yes, my pleasure. Thank you.
Steve Shaler, director of the School of Forest Resources at UMaine Orono. I do want to bring in a call. We'll go to Cam in Robinson. Hi, Cam. Welcome to the program. Very briefly, if you could, please.
Yes, I think my question may have been answered. It was this. Since the tree growth program incentivizes cutting as much as possible, and given that the forests are a sink for carbon, doesn't that work at cross purposes? And I wonder what the outcome was. Maybe I've already been answered.
Commissioner?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I have anything to add to what I've said previously. I mean, as I said, we're actually, you know, the growth has been exceeding our harvest level. So we're, you know, I think, again, we're in a place where we are really sustainably managing our forest resource, and we want to continue to do that. But as I said, also, we're looking forward to what comes out of the Climate Council conversation, recommendations, and, you know, looking at how we can play our part.
Let's go to Arthur in Hartford. Hi, Arthur. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, so I'm a certified organic blueberry grower, and in that capacity, I spend a lot of time at farmers markets, both in order to see what the other growers are doing and also to buy my own vegetables. I have noticed that when I ask a vendor at a farmers market whether they are organic or not, they generally say yes, even though they don't have any sign which makes that claim. And when I ask them what they mean by organic practices, they say, "Well, we don't use any insecticides." But then it often turns out that they use synthetic fertilizers and they use synthetic weed control, such as Velpar. Now, Velpar is not sprayed on crops. It is applied to fields the year before, but according to the
Arthur, we're running out of time. I apologize, but is there a quick question you have?
Yes, the question is, does the commissioner have a way of enforcing these regulations which the certified growers have to follow, but anybody can go to a farmer's market and make a claim?
I want to have time to let her answer. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, well, first of all, thank you for calling in, Arthur. I appreciate your perspective in this question. You know, as MOFCA Certification LLC does have sort of oversight over certification, I think it would be great, first of all, and you probably do this, to refer them to MOFCA's certification program to get educated, and it sounds like you're also helping to educate them as to what the National Organic Program rules are. We don't necessarily have, a role in that relationship between the certification services, but I think that what you're doing is definitely, pointing people in the right direction for information.
And with that, we are out of time. But thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Commissioner Amanda Beal, Maine's Commissioner of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. We had additional help from Scott McCallum. Ella Boyd took your calls. And you can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources, by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8 o'clock. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.